Crowley knows that this community is not going to just sit back, and we are going to keep them honest and on their toes from this point forward.
The city of McGrath gets into the fuel business. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 4th of May. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the case for keeping ANWR open for oil drilling.
I ask, if we don't drill here in America, where will we drill?
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
25 people turned out in Washington today to speak on the future of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is taking public comments as it prepares to update its comprehensive plan for the refuge, which was last completed more than two decades ago. Fish and wildlife officials say much has changed in the refuge since then, including new federal laws, concerns about the impacts of climate change, and increased public use, including from the now open Dalton Highway to the west. Nearly all of today's comments at the Interior Department headquarters centered on whether the coastal plain area should be designated wilderness or opened for oil and gas development. Only Congress can make those decisions, but Fish and Wildlife could forward a wilderness recommendation to the Interior Secretary, who could pass that along to the President and he ultimately to Congress. Alaskan Lucy Beach, who leads the Gwich'in Steering Committee from Fairbanks, says that's exactly what she'd like to see happen. Beach was just in Washington last week celebrating the refuge's 50th anniversary, but says over the weekend she saw a sight that cemented her resolve.
I've just returned from the Gulf of Mexico, and there are some places that need to be left off limits. We call this place Ijikwatsungwandaigudlut, the sacred place where life begins.
Beach and many of the other 20 people who testified in favor of protecting the refuge cited last month's oil rig disaster in the Gulf of Mexico, which is still gushing oil and threatens the coastlines of numerous states. But among the four people who testified in favor of opening the coastal plain to development, Carl Portman of Anchorage said the Gulf disaster should not end development everywhere. Portman is Deputy Director of the Resource Development Council of Alaska, a nonprofit made up of businesses, unions, and pro-development Native corporations and communities.
I ask, if we don't drill here in America, where will we drill? In concluding, the 1002 area of ANWR should not only continue to be excluded from wilderness designation, it should be open to responsible onshore development. My state's economy depends on it. We can have oil and gas development in a very small area of ANWR while maintaining the special values of the refuge.
The conservationists who testified said the 1002 area of the refuge, the coastal plain, is not small in its biological diversity and in the many animals and birds it hosts. David Jenkins with the group Republicans for Environmental Protection says its members want to protect all of the refuge and all of its habitats.
They see oil drilling in Prudhoe Bay and other parts of Alaska's North Slope. They know that vast expanses of Alaska's Arctic have also been made available for such development. And they come to the same conclusion that the Eisenhower administration came to 50 years ago, that protecting the Arctic refuge provides much needed balance. Our members also recognize that the Arctic refuge is unlike any other part of the American landscape, an Arctic and subarctic environment where wilderness can be experienced on an epic scale. Mountains, rivers, plains, seacoast, and abundant wildlife.
Fish and Wildlife will continue its scoping meetings in Alaska next week, with hearings in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and later this month in Koktovik. It's taking public comments until June 7th on the future comprehensive conservation plan. McGrath residents have had a bit of a reprieve at the gas pump. Crowley Maritime Corporation says a communication error caused them to charge too much, so they lowered the price by 72 cents per gallon. Still, the mayor of McGrath is working on finding an alternative for the community. APRN's Annie Fite reports.
Last week, McGrath Mayor Dustin Parker got a shock when he saw the price of gas rise more than $3 a gallon overnight. Crowley, the company that distributes gas in town, had to fly fuel in to fill its tanks. But Parker knew something wasn't quite right, so he called up Crowley Vice President Bob Cox.
I did explain to him that the price that he was charging made absolutely no sense with the amount that I knew I could get it landed in McGrath for as a regular citizen for over 3,000 gallons. He did tell me that he would look into this, and if he, too, could get gasoline flown in at that price, that he would lower his cost. And, you know, I have to hand it to him. He did do just that.
On Wednesday, Crowley dropped the price to $8.48 per gallon. The company has also offered to give refunds to the 27 customers who filled their tanks at the higher price. Cox says the mistake was the result of a miscommunication with the company that flies fuel in. He regrets Crowley didn't discover the error earlier.
Obviously, we got to do a better job here when we do our pricing so that we can catch these kind of mistakes.
Parker says the company should be more vigilant when it comes to price increases.
Do I really think that they would have noticed an error or an oops in their accounting system had the city of McGrath not, you know, made a big deal about this? My personal gut tells me no. And that's really why the city and the residents and the agencies within have really kind of had an issue all along with our business relationships with Crowley.
The city is working on a plan to fly fuel in to compete with Crowley's price. Parker says once the paperwork with the state is complete, they should be able to sell gas for around $6 a gallon.
$8.48 is still very expensive, and $8.48 is still a price that could, you know, potentially make people rethink their life in rural Alaska. That's why it's absolutely essential that the city of McGrath continue to move forward with dispensing fuel to our customers and our residents at the $6 a gallon rate.
Once Crowley is able to barge in fuel this summer, the city will probably get out of the fuel business. But Parker says city officials are exploring options for barging fuel in too. Cox says Crowley welcomes the competition.
There certainly is no restriction on other entities, if it's a co-op or if it's a city or if it's another private company that would go into McGrath and want to do what we do. We would only ask that it be a level playing field and that everyone follow the same regulations, whether it's DOT or EPA or IRS, you know, whatever. It should be a level playing field between all competitors in a community.
Now, heating fuel supplies in McGrath are running low. Crowley says it will have to start flying heating fuel to the village within the next week. Cox says the price will jump, but not as much as for gas. And he says there won't be any surprises for residents this time around.
One of the lessons learned from what we just went through here last week is we want to be sure that the community leaders know what we're doing and when we're going to do it so that the word can get out in the community.
And Mayor Parker hopes another lesson sunk in as well.
I think if anything now, Crowley knows that this community is not going to just sit back, and we are going to keep them honest and on their toes from this point forward.
In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, saying goodbye to a Bethel institution.
You know, this store served another purpose. It's sort of like the gathering place for people.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Alaska Native and conservation groups are challenging a decision by the Environmental Protection Agency to grant Clean Air Act permits to Shell Oil for drilling offshore exploration wells in the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas. The groups say the permits allow Shell's drillship and support vessels to emit tons of pollutants into the Arctic environment that will harm Inupiat people and wildlife and contribute to climate change. The group say more than 90% of the air pollution from Shell drilling would come from icebreakers and associated vessels, but the permits would apply control technology only to Shell's drill ship. The man who was initially in charge of the Exxon Valdez oil spill response says he sees some parallels with the current oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. Former State Department of Environmental Conservation on-scene coordinator Dan Lawn says the oil industry in the Gulf is again under-equipped for dealing with a large spill.
If you look at what they've got and you look at the news footage, you can actually see that they don't have the right kind of equipment out there, and they don't. And what they do have, even if it is the right kind of equipment, it's not enough. So they're in the same spot we were here in Valdez prior to the Exxon Valdez oil spill.
Lon says it makes him angry to see a scenario similar to what played out in Prince William Sound 21 years ago repeated.
We supposedly learned a lot of things during the Exxon Valdez spill, but we haven't seemed to implement much of what we've learned. We've allowed politics and the oil industry to bamboozle the public about how prepared they are for these events. You can't say that you can easily handle a spill because it's just not true.
Lon is a longtime critic of the oil industry and government oversight, and president of the Alaska Forum for Environmental Responsibility, a group he helped start after the Exxon disaster in Prince William Sound. Lon witnessed a lot of wildlife die from oil in 1989 and says there are tactics that could avoid a similar result in the Gulf if action is taken quickly.
Go out there and harvest everything you can, like oysters and shrimp and other kinds of critters, pick up some of those things and physically move them somewhere else. If they're too small for to use in the market, just physically move them to an area where the oil's not going to go. You know, and now we're worried about the endangered species, the brown pelicans. You know, one of the things that you could do is go physically capture them, pick them up, get ma and pa pelican and their nest and their eggs, move it somewhere where it's not going to be anywhere near the oil.
Lon says a large stadium could be set up with swimming pools as a temporary sanctuary for pelicans and other birds until it's safe for them to return to the wild. He says the stress of capturing and moving healthy animals is less than what they'd suffer from being oiled. Cruise ship season gets underway in Juneau today. The 965-foot Norwegian Pearl, with capacity for more than 2,400 passengers, docked this morning at about 8 o'clock. Princess Cruise Director of Shoreside Operations Kirby Day says most tours will be operating, so passengers should have plenty to do.
They're here from 8 in the morning till 10 at night, so it's a nice long call, so they'll get off and do some shore excursions and do some shopping downtown, and sounds like the weather's going to be okay, and looks real good.
515 ships will call in Juneau this summer. That's down from previous years, though conservative estimates still have more than 800,000 cruise ship passengers visiting the capital city in 2010. According to an April 2009 McDowell Group study, the average cruise ship passenger spends about $144 in the city. That pumped about $140 million into the local economy in 2008, when nearly a million cruise ship passengers visited. KTOO's Casey Kelly has a look at what local businesses are doing to prepare this year.
Last-minute landscaping was one of many items on Monday's to-do list at Tracy's King Crab Shack. Owner Tracy LaBarge says a lot of little things must be done before the food cart, located next to the downtown library, is ready for tourist season.
Maintenance, painting, it never goes quite back together the way it started every year.
LaBarge specializes in king crab from the Bering Sea fishery made famous by the Discovery Channel's Deadliest Catch TV show. She also sells locally caught Dungeness, and this year will be adding prawns to the menu. Despite an expected decline in cruise ship visitors this summer, LaBarge doesn't seem worried.
We'll see. I think this year, you know, last year was actually a good year for me. This year, two of my biggest ships, you know, where I did get a lot of people off those two are not here this year, so... But hopefully we'll make up for it on some of the other ships, the way they're coming in. So I think it'll be about even.
Over on South Franklin Street, retail shops are in various states of readiness. Some merchants are still moving in. Some won't be ready for the first ship, while others have been open for a month or more. Locally owned gift shop Hickox Trading Company is only open for the cruise ship season and a few weeks in December. Manager Lori DiCarlo says April is a stressful month.
Because I don't have any kids to work or any employees yet, and the bills are due the 1st of May, and I don't have a boat yet. So just getting it all priced, I get, you know, 150, 200 boxes at a time every week, and it keeps coming until the end of May, and then I have to reorder starting June.
DiCarlo says sales were down a bit last year, and with fewer boats, she's expecting another drop this season. But she says it always seems to work out.
They say we're supposed to have quality, not quantity, so hoping that they'll want to spend more than a dollar.
Year-round shops have it a little easier, but Alicia Smith, owner of Imagination Station Toy Store, describes the weeks leading up to tourist season as creating chaos.
We are moving things around so we can put out all our Alaska toys. We try to put the first quarter of the store, first half of the store, kind of Alaskan-y toys in books. So we're just trying to get it all out right now. It's a little crazy.
Imagination Station depends more on winter holiday shopping than on tourists. The store doesn't get the foot traffic that shops closer to the cruise ship docks get, so Smith is happy with whatever extra business the ships may generate.
It's definitely, there's fewer ships coming in, there'll be fewer people. I'm not too nervous about it yet. There's been changes recently with taxes, and, you know, you just sort of have to ride it out and see what's going to happen. I think that there are a lot of people out there that would still love to come to Alaska. So, and maybe we can bring them in as independent tourists. Who knows?
Six ships will visit Juneau this first week of the cruise season. Things get really busy on May 19th when five ships are scheduled to call in one day, potentially carrying more than 8,400 tourists. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. 90% of those who drown in boating accidents in Alaska are men. To get men to wear their life jackets, have them fill out a Pledge to Live card and make a promise to wear their life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Most men won't listen to messages like this, but they might listen to you. Go to pledgetolive.org to get a card or find one at your local car Safeway. Make them promise so they make it back alive. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety Program.
It was a fast and furious season for southeast herring gillnetters this year. Their two sacro fisheries opened a lot earlier than usual. Fishermen had little waiting time on the grounds, and the fishing itself went quick. Row percentages were reportedly good, which makes the catch more valuable. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports.
The Alaska Department of Fish and Game tries to open herring sacro fisheries when the fish are ripest with roe, and they mass together along the beaches to spawn. This year, the first signs of spawning happened more than a week earlier than in the past several seasons at Hobart and Seymour, and once it started, it went fast. Biologist Troy Tinas managed the Hobart fishery, which is located off the mainland coast north of Petersburg.
Yeah, it was very quick and hectic fishery there this year, to say the least, and actually between both fisheries, Hobart and Seymour.
After the department puts a herring fishery on notice, the fleet often has to wait several days, sometimes more than a week on the grounds before fishing can actually start. Not so this year. After the department and industry observed increased herring activity on the 21st, the department announced it was putting Hobart on notice as of noon the following day. With more signs that the fish were spawning, Tinas opened the fishery at 9:30 on the morning of April 23rd. Catch rates were good, and it closed 12 hours later that night.
We were getting close enough to the quota, but not quite there where we felt there tonight with typically catch rates greatly increase at night. And we also felt that we couldn't really adequately survey the fleet and felt we posed a risk of greatly exceeding the GHL. So we closed it down for the night and thought we'd reassess it in the morning, and we did do that.
They had another 4 hours to fish in the morning, but it didn't yield much more herring as the schools had dispersed. Overall, Tinas thought things went well at Hobart. He estimates the 45 boats there caught a total of about 305 tons, just 12% below the guideline harvest level. Gillnetters had little time to relax before Fish and Game opened the next fishery that same evening at nearby Seymour Canal off Southern Admiralty Island. Juneau area biologist Kevin Monagle says the fleet had some of the best catch rates he's seen, and he closed the fishery after 9 hours. Monagle says the herring spawned at both Hobart and Seymour were uncharacteristically quick this year.
For example, in Seymour Canal, in recent years, the main spawn event has been typically a 2 to 3 day event. This year, the main event was basically when we opened the fishery, and maybe a little bit prior to that. In some ways, it might have been nice to have opened even a little earlier, but we had one day of really good intense spawning with some good mileage, and that was it.
Monagle estimates the total catch at Seymour was about 737 tons, roughly 12% over the guideline harvest level. Icicle Seafood's fleet manager Randy Lantine calls the fishery a success this year. He credits the department for making the quick decision at Seymour.
As soon as Hobart was over, everyone went across Stevens Pass to Seymour, and we were seeing a pretty active spawn, so Fish and Game had to react quickly to make sure we didn't miss out on the fish.
Lantine says his company saw rope percentages of 12 to 14%, which is good quality fish. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
The spring bowhead whale hunt is on for the 10 whaling communities in Alaska. One village on St. Lawrence Island had a festive day this weekend with a bountiful harvest. KNOM's Lorelei Kanin has more.
The community of Gamble struck 3 bowhead whales all in one day this past weekend. Native Village of Gamble General Manager and Assistant AEWS Whaling Commissioner Branson Tungian says a busy few days of hauling and butchering began at 2 in the afternoon on Sunday.
Daniel Apasinaka came on the CV that he had struck a whale 14 miles south of Gamble. And as boats were heading over, they ran into whales. Daniel's older brother, John Apasinaka, was one of those that came upon a small yearling ingutuk and struck that.
Tungian says by 3 o'clock Sunday afternoon, more boats were heading out to assist with hauling, still the first whale.
When Mayor Wilbur Bushu came on the CB, that they had struck a whale as well. So in a matter of less than 1 hour, 2 other whales were struck.
The community on St. Lawrence Island has landed 5 whales this spring and sunk 2 in their total quota of 8 whales. Tungian says folks from the neighboring community of Savunga traveled to Gamble to help with butchering.
Tired folks, but lots of mangtuk. It's been a good whaling season for Gamble this year.
Tungian doubts hunters will head out to harvest the remaining whale in the community's quota set by the Eskimo Whaling Commission. He says they'll most likely focus their efforts for the remainder of the spring toward walrus and bearded seals. Tungian says a few years ago, 3 whales were struck in one day in Gamble. Reporting in Nome, I'm Lorelei Kinneen.
The K300 feed store in Bethel closed its doors last month. The store had been supplying area mushers and pet owners for 17 years. For member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes reports.
The smell of sizzling sausage welcomed customers as they entered the K300 feed store on Saturday.
Hi, Cindy. Hi. Just in time, got a fresh one on.
Longtime co-owner Bev Hoffman stood behind the grill, manning the cast iron skillet and flipping sourdough pancakes nearby. Loyal customers gathered inside the store in a circle of camping chairs. One of them, Sue Angstman, said she relied on the feed store for their bird seed supply.
I buy black sunflower seed and thistle seed for red poles. Red poles love thistle seed.
The feed store's last day was a surprise for some customers like Kathy Hansen, who just stopped by like she did about every other weekend.
I wondered why the parking lot was so full. I went, wow, they need to like clear out some more space. There are all these cars here. And where is everybody? They're not outside. So I had no idea. I just came to get some cedar.
That's cedar shavings for her tortoise. But instead of getting shavings on Saturday, she got teary-eyed as she sat reminiscing with friends.
I come every few weeks, fill up on dog supplies and tortoise supplies and, oh, bird seed. And for a while it was rabbits and everything that they've had.
Hanson says she'll get by now by buying from out of town, barging or mailing supplies in because it's too expensive to buy locally. But she says the store was much more to her than getting things for her pets.
You know, this store served another purpose. It's sort of like the gathering place for people. On Saturday, it was always fun to come here. And, well, today we got sourdough pancakes, but other times it was just maybe, you know, a little bit of sausage and conversation and advice and, you know, counseling about your dogs and stuff like that. So it's really sad to see it closing. It's just been a lot of fun over the years. Didn't realize it was 17 years. Oh my gosh. Too bad. Too bad, but things change.
Things are changing for the owners.
Oh, I'm ready for it to do something different.
John McDonald and his wife, Bev Hoffman, have been mushing dogs for years in Bethel and run the store to both help their own dog program and the K300. He says the nature of the business has changed throughout the years. When he first started selling dog food, it was $30 a bag, and now it's $60.
This bulky dog food and straw and stuff is very expensive to ship, and so the price of dog foods has gone through the roof. So people, mushers and people, do what they can to try and feed more fish or, you know, feed less dry food and maybe use less straw. And, you know, so the nature of the business changed through the last 15 years.
McDonald and Hoffman only kept half of the profits, though. The other half has always gone to the K300 races. K300 board chairman Myron Angstman says they are considering other options and locations for a new store.
We hope to have something going by fall because it's a, you know, important function to get stuff in here, quality gear and quality food. And so we'll try to figure it out.
In the meantime, Myron's wife, Sue, says she'll get her birdseed some other way.
This was just a good place to shop to support the K300. And it's kind of sad that they're closing.
In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Casey Kelly in Juneau, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, Laura Lykanen in Nome, and Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences. The Alaska Public Radio Network promotes Alaska's cultures, regions, and ethnic diversity, including a commitment to informing and empowering Alaska's Native peoples.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.